Welcome to Off the Page, the showcase podcast of the Creative Writing Society at the University of Nottingham. This episode is hosted by me, Matthew Bird, the president of the society.
And me, Madeline Roach, the webmaster.
This is URN.
As always, this episode of Off the Page will contain pieces written by members of the Creative Writing Society.
You can visit uncws.com to find out more about the society and to visit our blog to read even more pieces by the members.
So our first piece is a poem by Leora.
Hello. So this is a poem called The Gap Between. Smaller and smaller, down the rabbit hole we go again. Teapots are perfect for dormice to hide. But the Cheshire's grin hides pain. Some shells keep you trapped inside, others your home to remain. Blue-white heavens stare down coldly, hell yawns down below, whilst Charon's limbs stretch endlessly, sticks and stones, my girl, you know. Winter grows longer with each falling golden leaf marking the time between the breaths that fade with summer strength, the world of light and warmth and green. The silence of the morning grows inside like a secret hope for more summer green. My words aren't what matter. What matters, the gaps between.
The Alice references in that are just my jam.
Anything with Alice in Wonderland, I am so on board.
Now moving on to Maddie, who has a short story.
So this is called The Path from the Farmhouse to the Centre of Town. The sun beats down on Mary's back and warms her from the outside in. It's a lovely day. The sun is sparkling above, a soothing breeze fluttering through the trees, and the sandy path in front of her is dry, meaning it won't stain her shoes. She's wheeling her bike down the path from the farmhouse her mother owns to the centre of town. It's too hot to ride, and she's enjoying the scenery. That is until a figure on a bike comes whizzing past, throwing up sand and pulling off branches and leaves. As she comes closer, Mary realises it's a girl, her long curled hair erratically blowing around her face. Her dress is pulled up to her thighs and flaps around her knees relentlessly. She's grinning and squealing in glee until she brakes harshly and comes to a stop in front of Mary. Mary, the girl says. Elizabeth, Mary says. The scolding undertone is not missed by Elizabeth, whose grin widens. You'll kill yourself on that bike one day. We can only hope, Elizabeth jokes, before she's shifting and swinging her leg off the bike, her dress finally falling down to cover her knees. What are you doing here? Walking into town, Mary says, but makes no effort to move. Walking awfully slow. Maybe I was hoping to meet someone on the way. Elizabeth grins, looks around, and then leans forward and pecks Mary on the lips. Mary's cheeks glow pink, and when Elizabeth pulls away, she quickly looks around her to check no one is around. I love you, Elizabeth says, and then slips an envelope into the wicker basket of Mary's bike. She straddles her bike again and pushes the pedals around until one is comfortably under her foot. She pushes off just as Mary whispers a soft, I love you too. She grins over her shoulder and blows a kiss at Mary before she's aggressively pumping her pedals and is speeding off into the distance. Mary watches her go before straddling her bike and pedaling away. The wind winds through her hair, wipes away her tears as she longs for a time where she can love openly.
Not what I was expecting based on the title.
We deserve every happiness in life.
Thank you.
Is that Mary and Elizabeth from the first murder mystery this year?
Yeah.
Is it?
Oh!
Yeah. Because I wrote those characters, and then, like, I always find murder mystery characters who I, like, completely fall in love with and write loads about them. Although I'm not sure that's going to happen this time, considering the murder mystery we just had, all the characters were...
Kids
cartoon
TV
characters.
Show. Tinklives, Winklives, and
Dr.
Yeah, I don't think I'm gonna write about the romance between Big Cook, Little Cook.
Oh my god!
The Big Cook, Little Cook romance was incredible. Was it actually written on their characters?
No, so I wrote the characters and they had like a rivalry, and then Leela played Little Cook and I played Big Cook, and she came up to me and she was like, we should make this like a failed gay romance. Like, yes, definitely, let's do it.
And Megan was the accomplice, Raven.
At the charge.
Who Postman Pat summarily executed, like, who gave that man a gun?
It was the gun that
Velma used to kill Barney the dinosaur.
Wow, poetic justice.
Yeah.
Okay. We are now going to break for Book of the Week. This week's Book of the Week is Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. Jaden is going to read us an extract from the book.
Okay, so this is Good Omens. If you've not read it, why not? It's a great book. Anyway, it was a nice day. All the days have been nice. There have been rather more than seven of them so far, and rain hadn't been invented yet. But clouds massing east of Eden suggested the first thunderstorm was on its way, and it was going to be a big one. The Angel of the Eastern Gate put his wings over his head to shield himself from the first drops. "I'm sorry," he said politely. "What was it you were saying?" "I said that one went down like a lead balloon," said the serpent. "Oh yes," said the angel, whose name was Azrael. "I think it was a bit of an overreaction, to be honest," said the serpent. "I mean, first offence and everything. I can't see what's so bad about knowing the difference between good and evil anyway." "It must be bad," reasoned Azrael, in the slightly contorted zones of one who can't see it either and is worrying about it. "Otherwise you wouldn't have been involved." "They just said, get up there and make some trouble," said the serpent, whose name was Crawley. Although he was thinking of changing it now, Crawley, he decided, was not him. "Yes, but you're a demon. I'm not sure if it's actually possible for you to do good," said Azrael. "It's down to your basic, you know, nature. Nothing personal, you understand." "You've got to admit it's a bit of a pantomime, though," said Crowley. "I mean, pointing out the tree and saying, don't touch, in big letters. Not very subtle, is it? I mean, why not put it on top of a high mountain or a long way off? Makes you wonder what he's really planning." "Best not to speculate, really," said Azrael. "You can't second guess ineffability. I always say, there's right and there's wrong. If you do wrong when you're told to do right, you deserve to be punished." They sat in embarrassed silence, watching the raindrops bruise the first flowers. Eventually, Crowley said, "Didn't you have a flaming sword?" Said the angel again. A guilty expression passed across his face, and then came back and camped there. "You did, didn't you?" said Crowley. "It flamed like anything." "Oh, well, you look very impressive," I thought. "Yes, but, well, lost it, have you?" "Oh, no, well, not lost exactly, more, well." As Raphael looked wretched. "If you must know," he said a trifle testily, "I gave it away." Crawley stared up at him. "Well, I had to," said the angel, rubbing his hands distractedly. "They look so cold, poor things, and she's already expecting, and what with the vicious animals out there and the storm coming up, I thought, well, where's the harm? So I just said, look, if you come back, there's going to be an almighty row, but you might be needing this sword. So here it is, don't bother to thank me, just go do everyone a big favour and don't let the sun go down on you here." He gave Crowley a worried grin. "That was the best course, wasn't it?" "I'm not sure it's actually possible for you to do evil," said Crowley sarcastically. Azrael didn't notice the tone. "Oh, I do hope so," he said. "I really do hope so. It's been worrying me all afternoon." They watched the rain for a while. "Funny thing is," said Crowley, "I keep wondering whether the apple thing wasn't the right thing to do as well. A demon can get into real trouble doing the right thing." He nudged the angel. "Funny if we did both got it wrong, eh? Funny if I did the good thing and you did the bad one, eh?" "Not really," said Azrael. "No," he said, "suppose rang up." "I suppose not." Slate-black curtains tumbled over Eden. Thunder growled among the hills. The animals, freshly named, cowered from the storm. Far away in the dripping woods, something bright and fiery flickered among the trees. It was going to be a dark and stormy night. And that's the chapter.
So the next piece is a short story by Philippa, read by Maddie.
So I don't know why Philippa asked me to read this, because I can barely string a sentence together, but hopefully I will do it some justice. So it's called Handfast. Two red candles in brass candelabra, nicked from the loft. 3 yards of cheap black velvet, cut with blunt scissors. A stick of white chalk. Your hands are shaking as you pile it all onto the long table, obscuring the wine stains and the wafer crumbs and the pure virgin white of the altar cloth. The wooden cross hits the floor with a dusty thump. Check over your shoulder, smooth the creases in the velvet, check again. She's still there, waiting by the door, smoking a hand-rolled cigarette and watching the night. Her features are dark, her dress a washed-out used-to-be black. The headlight of a passing car sweeps across her, and for a moment she's a brilliant shock of sublime, illuminated in gold glory. The rusted chain from the door is curled, serpentine, around her shoulders, and a pair of bolt cutters hang loosely from her left hand, an afterthought. You turn back to the task at hand, picking up the chalk, drawing out a large, uneven circle. 5-pointed star, inverted. A circle at each point, maybe. Fuck, you think. Isn't there supposed to be a goat? I can't draw a goat. Jesus, I don't even know any Latin. You rifle through your backpack, pull out a cream-coloured tote bag and empty it out onto the table, adorning each point of the star with an offering. The rotting eye of a frog wrapped in cloudy cellophane, a deck of dog-eared tarot cards tucked in a velour bag, a 20-sided die blue with golden numbers, a round pebble of amethyst cracked down the middle, a tawny switch of hazel express delivered from Etsy. Next come the candles and a box of safety matches. Shh! Snap! The angle's wrong. You toss the splinters over your shoulder. Shh! 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 The phosphorus on the box discolours, goes dark and hard and used. No flame. Shh! 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 Bollocks! You throw your gaze to the rafters. The Virgin Mother above you shies away, turning her narrow white face towards the babe in her arms. His perfect form glows a warm mandarin in the midnight streetlight, which filters in through the stained glass, smearing out the colours of the crucifixion scene in a dreamy haze of blue, red and green. It's too much, too much, too fast. When your gaze finally falls, she's there. The bolt cutters lay forgotten on a pew in favour of your hands, which she holds in reverence. Let me. I'm sorry. It's fine. Her voice is a patient whisper. Her words feel like redemption. She takes the matchbox from you and, stuffing her hand in the pocket of her leather jacket, pulls out a lighter, her nails catching the light as she thumbs the flame into life. The varnish adorning them is streaked and chipped, spilling out onto the surrounding skin in a dry pool of blood red, but the pentagrams in the centres are perfect, meticulously inked in permanent black. Once lit, the candles are left to shiver in the frigid air on opposite sides of the circle, one tall, one small. She steps back and surveys your improvised offerings, wrinkles creasing the bridge of her nose as she purses her lips. Yeah, she says, that'll do, yeah. You sigh. It can't be right. No, no, it's fine. I wanted it to be perfect. It is. Her hands find yours again and gives it a squeeze. The metal of the lighter is hot against your palm. Her fingers are warm against your fingers. Anyway, I doubt his satanic majesty will care that much either way. You try to keep frowning, but she shoots you a sideways smile, one eyebrow raised, and you can't help the grin that spreads out across your face. Yeah, okay, whatever, you say, squeezing her hand in return. Let's just get this over with. I really don't fancy getting arrested on my wedding day. You return to your bag, pull out a headband and affix it to your hair, pull the black netted veil down over your face and head to the back of the church. Watch, wait, calm your short, nervous breaths. Lean against the marble font, standing where 18 years ago your own Virgin Mother had stood alone, bundled in travelling clothes, as the priest dripped holy water across your infant forehead in the dead of the night. A fresh start, a new beginning. She should be here, you think. She should have been a lot of places. There's no bridal march. No organ fills the ageing walls with the dronings of imminent matrimony. In the steeple, the bells are silent. Instead, there's a sharp jerk of her head, a beckoning motion of her hand, and the sound of your heavy boots against the grey tiled floor as you guide yourself slowly up the aisle. Your breath rattles in your chest. You force it through your mouth and out your nose. Calm yourself, calm your breathing, calm your tremoring heart. You stop in front of her, and arms reach away, and she lifts up the veil from over your face, smoothing it back against your hair. Hi, she says. Her gaze flickers over you, and right now it feels like being seen for the very first time. Hi, you breathe in return. She's taken your breath away before, in surprises and kisses and hands up skirts, but it's different this time. Existential. The sight of her burns your lungs and your throat, and forces you to reckon with the fact that you're here, you're alive, you're together. Reach out across the space, intertwine your fingers and hers. What now, you ask, and she shrugs. Do you want to marry me? You snort, look around. I think so, yeah. Do you want to be my wife? Uh-huh. Forever? Come on. Do you love me? You pause, take a breath. Yeah, I do. Of course I do. More than I know what to do with, I do. Half an hour later, her black lipstick is smeared across your mouth, your breast, the inside of your thighs. She's wearing your boots and you're wearing her tights, and you're both dressed in matching euphoric smiles. You give her a bracelet of twisted hemp, soaked in rose water. She gives you a necklace, a sprig of dry lilac pressed into the glass bead which hangs from the silver chain. You leave the altar cloth piled up like bedsheets, Leave the candles burning, leave the door ajar and the pews askew and the Virgin Mother blushing. Head out into the fledging dawn, head out with your hand in the hand of your lover, head home with your wife.
That was not what I was expecting.
That was fucking beautiful.
We love.
We stand.
We have much love.
To quote Philippa herself, we stand.
We stand, literally. Okay, so the next piece is going to be a poem by Leora.
Okay, so this one is called C-sharp. C-sharp. Screaming into the abyss won't bring you back. Wafer thin water over ever shifting sand. The sting of sea on freshly raised legs. Perfect, smooth, like the sand blown over the silver and gold empty beach. Shiveringly empty. The winter white, softer, weaker, cut deep by the shells which stick up like nails on unvarnished wood. Countless beauties jealously snatched up with every passing wave, thrown to and fro on the ocean floor. The sea is rich enough. Why does it keep taking? I roar, it roars back, warning me again of its everlasting hunger. It hits me in waves, lyrically, the storm of insurmountable nothingness. Foam curls round my shivering toes, digging deeper into the sand, questioningly. And in the foam, the souls of mermaids pay their respects. They, like us, had a wanderlust which carried them across the waves. An answer? A broken shell, leaving a wake of sand like a little boat. The storm is over now. The ocean heaves with slow rolling sighs, as though it knows the enormity of what has been taken from me. Lost forever in the deep, empty, treasure-filled world beneath. Its anger may be spent, but mine is not.
I love each line's an image, and even though sometimes they seem disconnected, it might be how you read it, but you link them so well.
Leora does poetry like we can't, and it's just...
Yeah.
Yes, you do!
Teach me your secrets. Yeah.
And now we've got another poem, this time by Catherine.
So this piece I've titled The Collector, and even though I'm in a very loving relationship, it's about fuckboys from the opinion of a fuckboy, just because all my friends are surrounded by them. And this is kind of my angry comment on it. The Collector. She quivers, a lamb yearning for the slaughter, by the boy raised on foul mouth and slapped wrists, eyes that pierce her glass chest, someone's daughter. Heart stretched and contorted like clay hereafter, a keepsake for the kiln, crafted by fists, of her quivering body, a lamb yearning for the slaughter. She wrestles and writhes on the nearest rafter. You had forgotten this feeling that you missed of piercing the glass chest of someone's daughter. She prepares and douses herself in water, bound and awaiting for his fabled kiss. She quivers, a lamb yearning for the slaughter. Her cavernous breast now filled with mortar, peel off skin and let hands know bliss as eyes pierce glass chests, someone's daughter. Aligned with the hunter and with the butcher, she dances in delusions of how they'll coexist, yearning as she does, a lamb yearning for the slaughter by eyes that pierced her chest, her father's daughter.
Wow.
Oh, Jesus.
No, there was no Jesus in that poem. Jesus was long absent from that poem.
Your writing is either so good and so thought-provoking,
or piss and what's it?
That cadence was just...
We're going to end the episode with a serialization, and this piece is by Leela. The next piece is the third part of a three-part serialization of three individual short stories set in the same universe.
So I've called this serial The Rain Has Been Falling for Several Weeks Now and the Government Has Done Nothing About It, and each one takes place at a different point in time in this universe. Alright, this is the third part of my serialization. The third piece and the final piece, I hope you've all enjoyed this, is called Music House. According to the sign outside, the concert hall is a house for music. You frown at the sign, Sounds don't have names. They just happen. Like when you plunge your hands into water or listen to a passing bird. You look up at the house. Cracks scar the walls like lightning. The water laps at them and opens them out further. The roof is fringed with shapes that remind you of paper scrolls, and moss shelters in the damp under their curling folds. You nudge your canoe through one of the larger gaps and squint at the water through hazy eyes. You can't see as well as you used to. It is misty with limestone beneath the surface, but not impossible to see through. Quicksilver fish, at least the size of your hand, dart through the debris far below, hiding from the storm between the intact four walls. You set up your hook and line before mooring your boat to a catch in the wall, where you think the remains of a picture once hung. It is pleasantly cool in the building after the thick humidity of the summer rain, so you resolve to stay for the night. After catching dinner, you carry on exploring, trying to find a dry place to light a fire and cook the fish. At the end of the corridor, you see a door so decayed that it looks like it would collapse with one touch. You pull down its salt-encrusted remains with a great splash, and droplets fly up from the water to catch in the glow of your lantern. The room behind is like nothing you've ever seen before. It opens out beyond you in shredded ribbons of gold and red, peeling paint still clinging to the little boxes attached to the walls. Metallic flecks sparkle under the still water, and every so often more scraps detach themselves and fall to join them. You sit cross-legged in the boat and stare for a long time, drifting in the centre of the music house as it yawns around you. Lightning occasionally flashes through the gaps in the rafters to illuminate detritus. When you first went out in a boat, you were six, and your mother was scared that you would get lost, so she insisted on going with you. You had intended to circle around the peak, but bad weather brought the boat to the neighbouring ruins instead. She taught you how to moor the boat and how to haul it behind the broken walls, out of reach of the wind. "Why are there homes below the water?" you had asked. "No one can live here." "This area was part of the peak once," she said, "but the water needed more space. Can you imagine? Once this place was filled with people like us." "Well, at least the fish are using it," you said, because even in the rough current you could see them sheltering with you below the waves. She laughed. "Yes, at least someone's happy." You imagine the music house filled with hundreds of people. You paddle to the walls of one of the boxes and find chairs screwed into the floor behind it. The fabric gives way under your weathered fingers. Perhaps it is like this somewhere under the water too, with chairs covered by cloth. It is hard to imagine people using them, for your reflection is your only point of reference. You haven't seen it for a while. Your mother gave you a small piece of mirror before she died, but you eventually threw it away. You didn't like that every time you looked into it, your reflection would have aged. You pull your boat out of the water and onto the stage. You unwrap some dry kindling from your tarpaulin with careful fingers and create a small pile on the floor. As you strike your flint and cover your pot to boil, you purse your chapped lips and whistle like the birds, a pattern of notes to make music. You wonder what kind of sounds people came to listen to here. On your second day in the building, you go hunting for scraps when you see a strange shape below the waves. At first, you think it is a large rock, but the shape is too smooth and unnatural, man-made. You tie up your vessel, take off your clothes, and peel your old diving suit over your skin. You secure your mother's snorkel over your face and dive, your bony limbs still practiced enough to propel you through the water. The shape is an immense hunk of metal bigger than anything you've ever seen. It dwarfs you. The light from above drops away as the structure blocks it completely. You run your hands over the surface, and in the blink of an eye, lights flare to life all along the sides in pairs. You see a door and circular windows. Your whole body is shaking. It's a working boat, and it's so much bigger than your own. It can create light underwater. It can dive like a human. You try smashing the lock with a stone, but the door doesn't open. Repeated attempts quickly tire you out, and you're forced to return to the surface and warm up. For a while, you float over the other boat in your own. You wonder how many people live in the boat and which peak they hail from. You watch fish passing around it on the way. Mother never told you anything about boats like these. When darkness comes, you row back into the main hall and decide to try again in the morning. You can hardly keep your eyes open, and your bones ache under your sagging skin. There's no longer enough light to see, so you grab your stones to light your lantern before mooring next to the box on the wall. You fall asleep to the sound of the drips on the glassy surface. The sound that wakes you is so loud, you jump hard enough to risk capsizing. It is still dark, but you can hear the force of it shattering the waves. It is followed by loud shouts coming from the entrance. You start up. They're voices. They're like yours. Clear and deep. So unlike the birds. In the middle of the great hall is the metal ship, floating, with two figures standing on top of it. They're shouting so fast you can't understand them. They look directly at you, holding the rock that you used to try and break in with. You feel tears welling up in your crinkled eyes. You jump from the boat without bothering to untie it. You don't care as it soaks your ragged clothes. One figure is a woman. She has two eyes, a nose, and such beautiful lips, just like mother, and she's dressed all in blue. They shout louder as you approach and point metal sticks forward. They wave their hands quickly. You swim closer, faster, spurred on by their greeting. You hear the sound again and feel something sting deep within your chest. You try to swim through the pain, but your vision is flickering to white. You must reach them. The water around you is slick and warm. The boat seems so far away. You must reach them. As you and Mother put the boats away, she told you about the time the rain came. Year after year it poured. People were frightened because they couldn't imagine life without land. But they kept making the rain fall, as they didn't know how else to live. Well, it doesn't really matter, you said. It's not like we can miss a world we don't remember. She sat with you on the grass by the water's edge and held your small hand, her turquoise dress spread around her like seafoam. You'll never forget the shape of her smile. Well, she said, I never thought of it like that.
Thank you.
That is all three pieces. Enjoy your climate change.
Can we try and not destroy the planet?
Yeah.
You heard it here first, folks.
Because unlike the old man in the third story who doesn't remember what the world was like before climate change, we will. And it will suck when we all drown. Which is exactly what's going to happen.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Off the Page, brought to you by the Creative Writing Society and University Radio Nottingham. For more information about the society, be sure to check out uncws.com. Come back for more writing by the Creative Writing Society. Thanks for listening.
This is URN.
Sorry.